Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Later in the show, we'll dig into the world of herbs with author Bevan Cohen. His new book, Herbs in Every Season, is a flavorful blend of gardening guidance, seasonal wisdom, and practical tips for using 48 edible and medicinal herbs year-round. From garden to kitchen, it's a guide to growing wellness one season at a time. We begin Main Street today with a conversation about a powerful new documentary, Change, Not Charity, the American with Disabilities Act. The film premieres tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on American Experience right here on Prairie Public, and will also be available to stream on the PBS app. Joining us are two of the key voices behind the project, writer-producer Shauna Lazit and director Jim Lebrecht. Welcome, both of you, to Main Street.
Thank you so much. Yes, great to be here.
Take us way back, and maybe we should even start with Crip Camp, Jim, if you could tell us what that was and how that then influenced this film.
Thank you for that question. Crip Camp is a documentary that came out 5 years ago, co-directed with Nicole Noonan and myself. We are a Netflix documentary that looks at a summer camp that I went to in the early 1970s, and how that led a lot of us to join the disability rights movement, which was really centered in Berkeley, California at the time. Crip Camp really kind of looked at not only what our journey was, but Judy Heumann, who was one, had been a camper at this place and then wound up being a staff member, how she and a few other people led a 26-day sit-in at a federal office building in San Francisco to demand that the Carter administration sign what are commonly known as the 504 regulations. And the 504 regulations really stated that if you were received federal money, that you could not discriminate against people on the basis of disability, which meant that universities and hospitals, schools, had to become much more accessible than they were. So that victory really kind of set the stage for the Americans with Disabilities Act, because what was missing was my ability or the ability of people who were deaf, neurodivergent, or disabled like myself. I can't walk. I use a wheelchair. You know, we were still not given the ability to freely enter public businesses or spaces like that. Companies could discriminate against us for hiring. So the ADA really was kind of based on the same concepts as 504. And that leads us to today, where I would say, and Shauna, I'm pretty sure this is kind of the way it plays out, is that Crip Camp really showed that there was an audience and a story, an unknown story for the most part, about the history of the civil rights movement for people with disability. Eventually, American Experience looked at what they were going to be pitching, and I had worked with Shauna for a long time. And you know, Shauna, you want to take it from there, how things kind of advanced from there?
So the executive producer of American Experience was the one who really kind of came up with the idea of doing a film like this. And the way it was presented to me was that it was going to be a film about the Americans with Disabilities Act, which I, you know, was kind of familiar, but not at all familiar. And what became so shocking to me as I started to learn more is to realize that the Americans with Disability Acts was this major piece of civil rights legislation that somehow we don't know about. A piece of legislation that is as consequential as the civil rights legislation of 1964 or 65. So we took that as kind of our starting point and then went backwards. You know, how did this extraordinary piece of legislation come about, and to realize that much of the answer to that was this extraordinary disability movement. That it was this, you know, after decades of trying to bring change to people with disability, and it's a large number of us in society, that they came together and to create this extraordinary movement. So in many ways, it's that interaction between a movement, a powerful, robust, vocal, demanding movement, in the best possible way, interacting with the powers that be in Washington to bring about this major legislation.
Johnny, you said you were familiar, but not at all familiar with the American with Disabilities Act. And I would share that I believe most Americans are right in that basket. What are the myths that you really hope this film gets to kind of blow up, so to speak?
Let me start off by saying that I think that, you know, when it first came out and businesses were starting to make modifications and spending the resources that were needed, there was a lot of pushback. Will this cost me too much money? Is it really worth it? But in the long run, what I believe is very, very true is that what business doesn't want more people to, either come through their door or into their website to hand them some money. And yeah, the people with disabilities, and included in this are people who are deaf or neurodivergent, make up at least 25% of our population in the U.S. And then also when you realize that, well, most of these people have friends and family, it's really, really a large group of people. And so what is important about this and what I'm concerned about today is that I've seen in my almost 69 years of life some incredible changes to my life, extraordinary changes where I have protections in regards to getting a job, that in new construction, I know that I will be able to get virtually everywhere in my wheelchair. And what's really important to me is that in the current environment politically, there are attacks not only on the 504 regs, but also really the ADA is not far behind. And when we look at supporting people, and we look and say, look, these laws are there to help make sure that someone's child gets an education. Or that someone like my good friend, filmmaker Jason DeSilva, has somebody that can come in. This is, with Medicaid, that somebody can come in and help him get dressed so he can make his next film. And, it's not like this is a hobby for people like me or Jason. He hires people. There's economics involved. And I don't like to equate someone's value with money, but this is kind of what we've been reduced to. So, I think to wrap up what I'm talking about here is that when you're unfamiliar with something or why it came about or why it's important, it actually, and a film like ours really points that out to people. And what I hope they realize that the community that I'm talking about is one that anyone can join any day. No amount of kale is going to protect you from being hit by a bus, is my way of kind of putting it in perspective. And so I hope this really is relevant to people, for their friends and family and the kids they know.
As a filmmaker, for both of you, really, how do you balance storytelling with advocacy to create an emotional impact that also then educates your audiences?
Yeah, this time it was not hard, because it is such a powerful and dramatic story, filled with, and the film is comprised of people who were participants and witnesses. And it is such a story of courage and determinations and twists and turns and, you know, never giving up, that the drama really carries itself. And the message carries itself. So it never felt like a choice. It felt like the story was really telling itself. And it's really powerful. And I think there's many lessons to take from it for today.
I think any good story is going to have people start conversations and consider things. So our mission here in our film wasn't made to be an advocacy piece. It was to really tell this history. But our history, no matter what community or what we're talking about, doesn't live in a vacuum. It lives in the world that we are currently living in. It so happens that right now, and look, we started working on this film over a year ago. So the kind of the political climate now was not something that either one of us were thinking about or anticipated. So I kind of say this because sometimes people think, oh, public media, you know, they're, you know, a bunch of lefties, or they're trying to always be political. Yes, indeed, our film involves politics, but it doesn't lean anywhere to the left or the right. And Craig, here's the deal. The Americans with Disabilities Act was a bipartisan piece of legislation. Sean and I were at the Bush Presidential Library, our first screening of the film, which was wonderful. And to be in that building and to, and to be able to talk to people. No one wants to, yes, I would like to protect the ADA or 504, but what I want to really do in this world is to show history, preserve it, and to have people naturally understand each other.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the new documentary, Change, Not Charity, the American with Disabilities Act. It premieres tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on American Experience, right here on Prairie Public, and will also be available to stream on the PBS app. With us are two of the driving forces behind the film, writer-producer Shana Gazit and director Jim Lebrecht.
Can I just jump in and just build on something that Jim said, and
sure.
Then Jim, please take over, which is when Jim was talking about the bipartisanship of this bill, and both Republicans and Democrats worked very hard to make it happen. It really is this kind of shining moment in our history where democracy, where government really worked and really came together to produce something that certainly benefited people with disability, but really benefited all Americans. And I just would like to highlight its importance as a shining example of how our government can function.
Jim, I'm wondering, what are the headwinds, the challenges for folks with disabilities that we should think about now that this film is coming out? And I'm thinking of technology. Technology's changing all the time and it impacts us. But I'm also thinking of maybe political headwinds, as you kind of alluded to just a little bit ago. What should we be thinking about relative to the American with Disabilities Act?
Well, if we look at our film and we look at really what people wanted, which was access to lives that everybody seemed to take for granted, you know, being able to go to the store and choose their own avocados, let's say. And that I think that the challenges today, I think you really kind of summed it up. It's a number of different things. When the internet really, you know, took off, there was no accessibility for people who, let's say, who were visually impaired, blind or low vision. And then interfaces with screen readers, and how is that all going to work? Well, technology eventually at least gets close to catching up. But today with AI, I've been doing a little bit of research myself about this. And what I'm hearing from folks is that this technology, which is you know, what do they call it? Scraping the internet for information. Well, the information around disability and the lived experiences with people with disability is not as available it is for other communities. And many times it's inaccurate. And so again, the learning, the teaching of these, you know, these technologies is going to take some time, but also what harm is that going to cause? And you know, I live in Oakland, California. And so in San Francisco, right across the bay, they have all of these autonomous taxis, these Waymo taxis. And, you know, with any new technology, they had their problems of, you know, driving into construction sites and all sorts of things. Well, if I think about myself, I'm rolling around in my beautiful power wheelchair, and are these technologies really set up to recognize someone like me who travels horizontally, who's half metal and half meat? Do they really get that I'm a human being and that they need to, like, do they recognize me? Now, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm not a fearful person, but I don't give those cabs any credence that they know what the hell they're dealing with when they approach me.
Are there elements of the ADA that either of you were surprised by or maybe changed your understanding about relative to disability justice as you researched and created this film?
That's a good question.
Maybe I'll just start by saying that the monumental transformation that happens with the 504 regulations and with then later on with the ADA is the shift from understanding disability as kind of a medical condition to something that is about civil rights. And that is the transformational moment, which then this legislation is built on. So as soon as we begin to understand our society as all members having civil rights, then it really does kind of change the character of the society. And so that's something that why, you know, losing aspects of 504 or losing 504 or losing the ADA really would be such a kind of to say going backwards doesn't even begin to really express that, because we really built a society where everybody, or at least many, you know, fundamentally have civil rights.
I'm going to have the opportunity to watch this film with my granddaughter, who is a sixth grader. So we're going to have a sixth grader and a very old guy watching this film. What do you hope each of us take away?
I delight in the image I just got in my head of the two of you watching. Sean has directed many more films than I have, but I'll give you one piece here just from my experience with Crip Camp, which is that Nicole and I and the folks on the film started seeing a lot of things on social media. And somebody with cerebral palsy said, I watched this film with my parents and now they understand. And so I love the opportunity that you will have with your granddaughter to watch our film and ask her what she thought and how she feels. Because I find that, you know, younger people are really curious, but also empathetic.
She's going to totally get it. She's going to really totally get it.
What I hope she gets out of it, quite frankly, and you can chime in for sure, the history of why it is so important. Not necessarily that it is, because they've seen the curb cuts. They've seen accessibility features in elevators and other things. They've seen those things without ever thinking about why.
But it's also kind of on a human level, in the generation that Jim and I come from, being similar in age, it's why we made the decision to start the film with the Jerry Lewis telethon, which is what I grew up on.
So did I.
You know, yep. and you know, watched every year and thought it was the, you know, what could be nicer and kinder, more so that, you know, it does. It never occurred to me that the telethon would not be liked by people with disability. And so I think that I've had to make that transformation within myself, but the 60-year-old won't. I mean, she'll grow up with, you know, kind of a much purer sense of how everybody is really part of society.
The pushback on the telethons simply was they were using pity to bring in the donations, and they were framing us as helpless, pitiful people. And so try going for a job interview the next day after that, because it was seen by millions of people. You've seen Craig curb cuts coming in and the Braille and elevators, but not only your granddaughter, but a number of young people with disabilities, like it's always been there for them. And I hope they realize that this wasn't just, you know, the way things always were and it was given to them, but that we had to basically make legislation so those things would be available to them. And having grown up in a world that wasn't built for me, and I think that I'm in a world that for some people don't want to see me or have me or believe that I am incompetent by looking at me, our film shows the disabled community at its best.
What's so fabulous is that there's a woman in our film that says, because as part of the protests, you know, people were arrested and put their bodies on the line. And the line goes, you know, who would have thought, you know, cripples could do this? And so it completely changes the paradigm of what disability is into something that can be full of strength and courage and determination and focus and really, honestly, incredibly sophisticated, strategic, political thinking and doing.
And the way that was simply phrased really talked about the radicalism that we realize that people look upon us as less than and as cripples is a derogatory term. They were using that, you know, at that point to really press people's buttons to pay attention.
Shauna Gazit and Jim Lebrecht, thank you both so much for joining us here on Main Street and for sharing the story behind Change, Not Charity, the American with Disabilities Act. It's an important and timely film, and we're grateful for your work in bringing this history to life. We look forward to the premiere tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on American Experience here on Prairie Public, and we encourage everyone to tune in or stream it on the PBS app. Coming up next on Main Street, it's time to dig into the world of herbs with author Bevan Cohen. His new book, Herbs in Every Season, is a flavorful blend of gardening, guidance, seasonal wisdom, and practical tips for using 48 edible and medicinal herbs year-round. From the garden to the kitchen, it's a guide to growing wellness one season at a time. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by NODAC Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodacins.com.
And we continue Main Street today with Bevan Cohen. He's the author of Herbs in Every Season. It's an inviting exploration into growing, harvesting, and utilizing 48 different edible and medicinal herbs across each season of the year. Springtime. This is a good topic, Bevan. Welcome to Main Street.
Craig, thank you so much for having me here today.
Tell me, what initially sparked your passion for herbalism and gardening?
You know, I have been fascinated with plants my entire life. When I was a young boy, I lived with my grandmother, and we lived on the edge of town next to a couple thousand acres of woods. And so I would spend all of my days, you know, tromping through the forest and having a good time and, you know, picking berries and doing the things that kids will do. And one day I was sitting out there and there was some wintergreen growing, and, you know, it's a low growing plant. It grows along sort of the forest floor, and it's got these beautiful red berries. And I just thought they were so beautiful and so cool, and you can eat them, and it was a fun tree. And I got to thinking, you know, just in this little patch of woods that I live in, there are so many cool plants, so many interesting plants with so many different uses. And my grandmother would take me to the library all the time. So, and I was always reading books. I was an avid reader. I always have been. And so I started reading about these different plants that I would find in the woods. And I thought, gosh, if there are so many interesting plants just in this little part of the world where I live, how many plants are there in the whole wide world? And it really just started a lifelong obsession with all of the plants that, you know, any plant I could find and use and eat and find a use for. It's just, that's what brings me joy in life, I guess.
Bevan, can you share an experience you've had when working with herbs that have dramatically impacted your personal health or perspective?
Well, sure. I think the most obvious answer here would be that I spend a lot more time outside, right? I'm going to spend a lot of time seeking out plants in different places. So that means I'm out hiking in the woods, I'm out working in the garden, I'm kayaking, whatever it might be. So it certainly has increased my physical activity, right? But also, I mean, we could say I'm probably eating more fruits and vegetables. I eat a lot of plants, you know, I'm curious about plants. I'm finding them. I'm finding ways to consume them. It's increased my personal relationships with folks. You know, I spend a lot of time meeting other plant people. I teach now a lot. We do a lot of education programs. I go to farmers markets and interact with people, you know, and I think that that's really good for my overall health as well. So almost every metric that we might use to measure my health, I think in some way has been improved by plants.
I have to ask you, have you ever made a mistake and maybe eaten something you probably shouldn't have?
Sure. Yes, probably I have. So, you know, that's a good question. And when, you know, we teach, when I'm teaching people about plants, especially people that are very new to the world of plants, I really want to emphasize the importance of proper identification. We want to make sure that we understand what a plant is well before we even harvest it, let alone try to consume it. You know, because it could be dangerous. Some, you know, it might just make you feel not so well, but other things, it could be more serious than that. At the heart of our teaching, I really try to emphasize the importance of relationships with the natural world, right? The relationships with plants, the relationships that plants have with the earth, whatever it might be. And part of that relationship, I would say, even at a surface level, is identification, getting to know the plant very well. You should be able to understand that plant throughout its life cycle. And that's why in the book, we've approached plants through the lens of the seasons, because I think that is such a valuable way to get to know plants is through their life cycle, watching how they grow and change throughout the course of the seasons.
Speaking of seasons, when I was contemplating visiting with you, it's like, okay, I'm in North Dakota here. I can grow stuff from the end of May to maybe mid-September, maybe the 1st of October, and that's it. Then we'll wait and talk about the garden next year. But really, you advocate for some year-round activity here, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. There's many things that we can do year-round, even if we have a short growing season. Here in Michigan, where we're at, you know, our last frost date's about mid-May, and our first frost is going to be mid-October. But that doesn't mean we can't do lots of great things with plants. Obviously, well before my frost date, I have to get some seeds started and that sort of thing. I'm planting my garden. I'm involved in plants in that way. But we're going to be able to bring a lot of plants into our home to enjoy in the winter as well. We talk about a lot of plants in the book that are just in your home probably right now, and you may not even realize how valuable they could be. Something like the aloe that you might have growing on by a bookshelf or something in the corner, the cinnamon in your spice rack, the green tea that we might drink. We lean into all of these plants to help people see that plants and all of the wonderful things they offer to us are accessible all year long.
What are some common misconceptions that you run into over time that people might have about growing and using herbs?
Well, you know, a couple of different things, I suppose. I'd have two answers here, one for growing and one for using. One common misconception I see with growing herbs is that people that have never done it before are very hesitant to get started sometimes. They're nervous that they won't do it right. They're going to make a mistake. The things are going to go wrong. And, well, that's kind of a silly way to think about it. I mean, one, you got to try new things, and sometimes it might go wrong, and that's how we learn, and that's okay. But herbs are very forgiving plants. Herbs are very easy to grow. Any beginning gardener, anybody who's just starting to grow for the first time, I suggest growing herbs. They're much easier to grow than some of the other plants that we might be interested in. So have no fear. When it comes to using plants, I see that a common misconception might be that people that think that plants aren't as powerful as they may be. From a medicinal standpoint, we're used to pharmaceutical drugs. We're used to a medicine that you can take it and like, pow, it's you notice its effect almost immediately. And so we tend to think, oh, plants, they're not going to do much for us. But plants are very powerful. And even like we talked about, plants can be deadly, right? If you misidentify plants, plants are powerful. And that is a common misconception. But both of those misconceptions can easily be resolved by developing that relationship with plants and just spending some time in the natural world.
So someone who has limited gardening experience, or even space, I guess, what advice would you give them out of the gate? You say, you can do this. Well, how do we do this? How do we start?
Well, you know, I always like to recommend to folks to connect with other gardeners if you can. You know, if you have a local herb society, a master gardeners organization, a garden club through your local library, that's a really nice place to kind of build that community, to become a part of that, to meet other growers, to learn from, most certainly. You can go to your greenhouse. You can go to your big box stores anymore and even buy little plants, you know what I mean, to help you get started. And then just do it, right? That's a simple phrase, but that's really just all that it is. Even if you've got limited space, you can grow so many wonderful herbs in containers. For that sort of thing, I'm often going to recommend to folks plants that are in the mint family. So, of course, mint and spearmint, but also plants like lemon balm or oregano or thyme. These are all plants that, number one, very easy to grow. Number two, they thrive in containers. So you can grow them absolutely anywhere, regardless of the space you have available.
Can you explain the significance of herbal remedies being prepared seasonally rather than just sourced online year round?
One of the most interesting things about working on this book for me was trying to approach herbs through the seasonal lens caused me to slow down and observe these plants through their life cycle. And what we discover is the plants that we need are available to us right when we need them. Not only do plants change throughout the seasons, but we change as well, right? So our needs are going to change. So in the springtime, we might be looking for herbs that are good for possibly for our allergies, or herbs that are good for resilience for our digestive system, right? And those herbs appear to us. Nettles, stinging nettles is a fantastic plant for our allergies. Right when we're struggling from allergies, that plant appears. When we move into summer and it's hot and we have tired and sore muscles from working in the garden, no problem at all. Nature provides. Just that simple peppermint that I already mentioned is a wonderful cooling herb, but it's also great for pain relief. So right when we need that plant, it's ready for us. We can move all the way. One of my favorite examples in the book, I kind of push the boundaries, to be honest with you, on what I consider an herb. Some of the plants we discuss in the book aren't, botanically speaking, necessarily herbs, but they're valuable plants, and I wanted to talk about them. One of the plants we cover, well, it's not even a plant at all, shiitake mushrooms, right? A fungi, it's not even a plant. But mushrooms are high in vitamin D. And we discuss that plant, that fungi, in the winter. When our bodies need more vitamin D, those are the plants that are there for us that are available. So it's just fascinating to see that literally as we change and develop and our needs change with it, nature is right in step with us, providing us with those plants every step of the way.
We're enjoying our conversation with Bevan Cohen. He's written Herbs in Every Season. He's an experienced herbalist, educator, and gardener whose work emphasizes the symbiotic relationship between humans, plants, and their environments. Of the 48 herbs you've covered, and you've talked a little bit about your favorites, but do you have one that this is my favorite herb and why?
Craig, this is an impossible question, my friend. You know, I would say, what is my favorite herb? And I think that the answer would change depending on when you asked. You ask me next week, I'll probably have a different answer for you. You know, right now, in this exact moment in time, while we're recording this, I would answer and say parsley is my favorite herb. And that's only because in my gardens in Michigan right now, my parsley is already coming up. It's a biennial plant, which means it stays in the garden over the winter. And then in the second year, it'll grow again and then produce its flowers and seeds. So here in Michigan, my parsley is already coming up. I've already been able to harvest a small amount of it to eat and enjoy. And it is just such a flavorful and nutritious plant. So for that reason alone, just because I'm picking it and eating it out of the garden, that would have to be my favorite plant right now.
I think of traditional medicine when I think of herbal medicine. Are they the same?
Well, herbs and plants in their whole have been a part of traditional medicine. So I would have to say, yes, absolutely. The medicine that people have been making for thousands of years, that traditional medicine is almost always plant-based. And even some of our modern pharmaceuticals are plant derived originally, or now they've learned how to synthesize the particular compounds that once originally came from plants. So even in our modern medicine, at the heart of that is the power of plants.
One thing I've wondered about too, as we've been talking, how does the layman understand, okay, I have these plants and I don't have the expertise even to think about maybe I want to sleep a little better, so I'm taking X, or I feel anxious, so I'm looking for Y, but I have this that I don't overdose or underdose, or how do I get the doses right when I'm thinking about these things?
Well, to give you like an oversimplified answer, I'm going to say always use less than you think, right? Starting with smaller doses and working your way up is very important, of course, so we don't overdo it. But before you start dosing yourself with medicine or crafting medicines, again, we want that relationship with the plants. We want to understand that plant. You need to know the plant and what the medicine it offers you even is before you start crafting something. So in the book, you know, we've broken down each of the 48 herbs into sections. So we talk about the herb, generally speaking, where you can find it, some folklore about it, some of the chemical constituents of the plants. Then we talk about it from a medicinal standpoint. Then we also talk about it from a culinary standpoint because, you know, well, food is medicine, right? But to be realistic, we use a lot of herbs in the kitchen. So I wanted to talk about that. We talk about growing and gathering the plants, all of the things that you need so you can begin developing that relationship and getting comfortable with the plants and understanding them, which is the first step before you even start making any medicine.
I would ask you if there's one herb that we all maybe should incorporate into our daily lives, in our diet, in our routine. What might be one we should maybe do a little more research about?
That's such a good question. I'm going to say lemon balm. For folks that prefer Latin, we're going to say Melissa officinalis. This plant's going to check so many boxes for us. One, it's in the mint family, so it's easy to grow. So any one of us can grow it. It has a delightful lemon flavor, so it can quickly be incorporated into many applications. Something as simple as a homegrown lemonade-style beverage. In the book, we even do a lemon balm and shiitake stuffing, so you can really experiment with the foods. Medicinally, the lemon balm is antiviral, so it's good for cold and flu. So that's important for all of us. But most important, lemon balm brings joy. It's a plant of happiness. It helps with stress. It helps with anxiety. I've never seen anyone even smell a lemon balm plant and not immediately smile. And if you've ever been on the internet or if you've ever watched the news, we can assume and know everybody needs a little bit more joy and peace in their life right now, right? And lemon balm is the solution.
Do you get any pushback from traditional physicians, et cetera, who practice Western medicine? Do you get any pushback from what you suggest in your book?
No, I don't really think that I do. You know, if anything, maybe like a bit of a laugh or, you know, that, you know, just kind of shuffled off to the side, that might happen. But I think more and more modern medicine practitioners are seeing that value in the plants. I mean, they all know where all of their medicines originated from anyways, you know, that they know that everything was at one time plant derived. So I don't think that it's really a challenge. I think that these two things exist together in harmony. And I think that that's an important thing. I mean, herbs are good for a number of things, but for serious medical ailments, you should still seek out, you know, modern medical attention. You should still go to your doctor and that sort of thing. I'm not suggesting anything other than that. You know, it's most certainly that we do that. I think that these two things can exist simultaneously in peace.
What's the most unexpected discovery you've made along the way? Something that just wowed even you?
I'm always wowed about how people don't seem to appreciate the weeds in their yard. So that's going to be my answer. Anytime I talk to somebody, I was just gave a talk for a garden club and I mentioned dandelions. And I was about to talk about, you know, the virtues of the dandelion plant. And half that room looked like they're about to walk out on me. They could not even believe
I'm cringing now because I work to kill dandelions. Uh-oh, what am I going to hear?
Right? So, it's shocking to me from somebody who embraces these plants to see this completely polar opposite point of view on some of the most valuable herbs that are accessible to us. You know, the entire dandelion plant is edible and useful and medicinal, and it grows, well, like a weed, right? It's very easy to produce. I always joke, you know, if somebody could tell me five uses for grass, then maybe I would be more tolerant of that instead of the weeds in my yard, right? And I have never heard anyone give me five. I've heard, you know, oh, feeding cows or playing baseball and those sorts of things. That's valuable. I agree with those things. But I could give you far more than five uses for dandelions. So I think at the end of the day that maybe I would win that argument.
I feel so guilty now visiting with you. I want my yard to have nothing but grass, but I certainly understand your point. I've actually heard it before on people should consider xeriscaping. I mean, that's some of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. The less that we mow, the less that we do. I mean, we're going to find these cool plants. It's going to be great for the pollinators. It's going to bring in insects, which brings in birds. It is the base of the entire ecosystem, these wild plants. But don't feel guilty and don't feel bad. And that's an important thing here. And this is a message we try to convey in the book as well, is that we're all coming to this from a different place, from a different point of view. And we can always just maybe learn something new or change our point of view and perspective and then do what we can with that knowledge from here, right? We're all growing, we're all trying, and we're all ultimately trying to just have joy in our lives. Just maybe we can do it in different ways sometimes.
After I spent how much money landscaping our front yard for our new home, Bevan? Oh, the book is Herbs in Every Season. What's next? What do you plan to do next, Bevan?
Well, I'm obviously very busy promoting the book right now, and I'm so excited to have this opportunity to get out and share this book with the world. It has been many years in the making. I've been studying the uses of plants my whole life, and to be able to finally get this book together, to get it out into the world, I'm so excited about it. So we're doing a lot of promotional tours for this. There's a lot of that happening, but there's always something new. I mean, right now we're in the middle of planting the garden season. So the garden's coming and spring's rolling. So I always just like to stay out of the way and let nature unfold for me, for sure, to see what's going to come next. But right now, it is all about celebrating those seasons.
Bevan Cohen has been my guest on Main Street. The book is Herbs in Every Season. He offers practical advice suitable for both novice and seasoned herbalists. He emphasizes the relationship between herbal practices, seasonal cycles, and personal wellness. Bevan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig. I had a great time hanging out with you today.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra presents Cartoon Capers, a family concert of cartoon and Disney favorites. Saturday, April 5th at 2 p.m. at the Fargo Theater. Arrive early for the musical instrument petting zoo. Details at fmsymphony.org.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The sweeping scenes of bison herds in Dances with Wolves spark the imagination, but the reality of their historic numbers on the northern Great Plains is almost beyond belief. Some estimates suggest 30 to 60 million bison once roamed North America. First-hand journal entries from early explorers like Isaac Stevens offer powerful glimpses into their abundance, such as rivers choked with drowned buffalo in spring. These vivid accounts help us picture what once was and reflect on what was lost, as Chuck Lura tells us in this natural North Dakota.
I happened to notice that Dances with Wolves was running on one of the cable stations recently. That 1990 film starring Kevin Costner had some great scenes of bison herds and a bison hunt. I could not help but imagine what those immense herds of bison looked like before European settlement. The historical range of bison covered much of North America, including, of course, the northern Great Plains. Historical estimates vary widely, with some estimates coming in at between 30 and 60 million or more. It's hard to imagine, but we do have written accounts that provide insight into the bison's abundance. In the summer of 1853, Isaac Stevens was in what is now North Dakota, exploring a route for a Pacific Railroad. On July 10th, his expedition was camped near present-day Binford in Griggs County. Stevens wrote in his journal, and I quote, "Crossed the Cheyenne. Every square mile seemed to have a herd of buffalo upon it. I had heard of the myriads of these animals inhabiting these plains, but I could not realize the truth of those accounts till today, when they surpassed anything I could have imagined." Unquote. Alexander Henry the Younger ran a trading post near the confluence of the Park River with the Red River for a few years around 1800. He kept a journal, and here are some quotes from his journal during the spring of 1801. "Imagine the scenes he experienced, beginning with the ice going out of the Red River on March 30th. Make a note of that date. Quote, great numbers of dead buffalo which come from above must have been drowned in attempting to cross the river while the ice was in a weak state. April 1st. One continual line in the middle of the river for 2 days and two nights. April 18th. Drowned buffalo still continue to drift down the river, but not in such vast numbers as in the beginnings, as many are lodged on the banks and along the beach. April 30th. Buffalo continue to drift as usual. May 4th. Annoyed by the stench arising from the vast numbers of drowned buffalo that lay on the banks and are now in a state of putrefaction, I was actually prevented from taking my supper. Unquote. Other observations in the journals of Lewis and Clark Expedition, Charles Fremont, Charles Chaboyer, and others attest to the historical abundance of the bison on their native range. And although we can imagine those immense herds of bison, it's still difficult to put it into perspective, particularly in light of the slaughter that came afterwards. I'm Chuck Lura.
That was Chuck Lura, a longtime biology professor at Dakota College at Botno, where he published research on ecological aspects of grasslands in the northern Great Plains. In retirement, Chuck continues to share his natural North Dakota essays for the Prairie Public audience.
This is Dakota Daybook for March 24th. On this date, in 1917, newspapers across the country reported that heavyweight contender Jim Barry was shot and killed. He was in Panama for a title fight against Sam McVay, who later brought the news back to New York. Many differing stories have circulated about Barry's life, death, career, ethnicity, year of birth, and origins. The globe-trotting boxer had been described as both a Chicago man of mixed heritage and a hard-hitting white cowboy from Montana. He was a bare-knuckle prize fighter and protege of legendary heavyweight champion John L. Sullivan. In 1916, he told the Bismarck Tribune, "Jim Barry isn't my name at all, and I'm not Italian as everyone believes. My real name is Hugh Edgar Rogers. My mother was a full-blooded Sioux Indian." Genealogy records show he was baptized Lewis Edgar Rogers. His mother, listed as Indian in the 1910 census, had mixed Chippewa fur trade heritage. His father was a hardy frontier mail carrier who made a 400-mile round trip on foot or by dog sled between Fort Abercrombie and Grand Forks. Barry claimed he grew up in Drayton with his family, had six brothers all bigger than he, and rarely spent time in Chicago, though everyone wanted him to say he was from there. He was reportedly shot in the back three times by Tex Martin in a hotel bar. Sources in Panama said the shooting resulted from a dispute over a gambling debt, not a saloon brawl or shootout as reported elsewhere. Barry was said to be in possession of a gold and silver-plated, diamond-studded championship belt entrusted to him by John L. Sullivan. It was estimated to be worth $10,000. The belt was never found at the hotel where Barry stayed. Some years later, Sullivan's belt, or a replica, was found and displayed at the Smithsonian Institution. The diamonds had been chipped off, and it was speculated that Barry or Sullivan may have sold them. Sullivan had pawned the belt from time to time, and in 1901, a jeweler created a replica for display at the Buffalo World's Fair. It remains unknown whether the belt at the Smithsonian is the original or a replica. Lewis Edgar Rogers, born August 12th, circa 1885-1888, died March 12th, 1917. He is buried in Oakwood Cemetery, Walsh County, North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Lee Zerdrick. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
We're inside a Chinese restaurant, or as it would be known here in Beijing, a restaurant. We're reporting from here, and on the next morning edition, we will hear what a Chinese scholar thinks about Donald Trump's America. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll spotlight the upcoming Fenworks North Dakota Esports State Tournament that takes place this coming weekend at the University of North Dakota and will feature hundreds of high school competitors from around North Dakota. And it's organized by Grand Forks-based Fenworks. That's tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.